Hello and welcome back to episode 10. This is a big number. We made it into double digits. Yeah.
Well, you guys have made it into double digits. I'm still a couple of episodes away.
Yeah. So actually, the work party doesn't apply to you yet. It's just for me.
Yeah.
Keep my cake in the fridge.
Yeah.
Presumably 4 or 5 months.
Yeah.
Episode 10 of the Hot Air Outtake podcast. Mm-hmm. A lot has happened. My God.
A lot and yet nothing.
Yeah. Weirdly. Consult the graph. This might, I'm putting this in massive air quotes, this might be a shorter episode.
I'm looking at the runtime of the video now and you fucking lied to me.
Yeah, I probably have. But yes, we do have the triumphant return of Show and Tell this episode. Mm-hmm. Because we actually managed to put a modicum of planning into things, but also things have happened to us is the main thing.
Yes, we've all been in situations.
But to quickly, before we even delve into Show and Tell too much, we
is this our Raycon sponsorship?
Raid no, Shadow Legends. Sponsored...
Yeah. I've been struggling recently with the heat, as I'm sure you guys have as well. And to help me get through it, I've been using BetterHelp. But we will all of us be at Festival of the Unexceptional on the 25th of July.
Yes, that is true.
That is possibly not enough time to get my car sorted, but I'll be there either way.
Well, yeah, will yes. be might be a yeah, little too much confidence. Foot. Probably if will
you,
be.
If you see me with my thumb out on the side of the M25, please pick me up. It's going to be hot.
Oh. Just like the scene is like when in movies when people are trying to get hitch a ride, like Death Valley.
You get, yeah, like, basically.
You're actually going to be walking along and your vision will like Breaking Bad Mexico turn everything into like a piss filter.
Silverstone genuinely looked like that at the weekend. It was so dusty.
Yes, yeah. We should probably add as well, we're recording this just before the Festival of Speed, so by the time you watch this, there may have been a few more announcements, and, you know, car companies like to throw things out there during that week, so that'll be covered in the next episode in 4 months.
Indeed, yes. So something to keep you on tenterhooks and stay tuned for.
Mm-hmm. Don't form your own opinions as a better.
Indeed.
Because we know what we're talking about. We are professionals.
Yeah, we have a podcast.
Exactly. Like, come on.
They don't give those out for free.
I had to get a license for this microphone.
I wish. I
have a nice crispness to my voice that you do not. In with your shitty little laptop microphone. Therefore, I have more authority than you.
Mm-hmm. That is how it works.
That's true. The bit rate of your voice directly corresponds to how valuable what you're saying is.
Mm-hmm. Yes. But to move on to Show and Tell, I'll start simply because my slide is first. And
this looks sad. I'm assuming this is not a good story.
And your tragedy is greatest?
Actually, I have reason to believe my tragedy is not greatest, but we'll get to that later. No, the tragedy is that the Renault failed its MOT, perhaps unsurprisingly.
Womp, womp.
Sorry, yeah, there were a few... You just say womp, womp. But
elite ball knowledge.
Indeed. There were a couple little shitty, annoying things that it failed on, so the LED bulbs I put in it are not MOT compliant. That's my own stupid fault. I probably should have known that. The wiper blades on it don't, like, make contact with the screen properly. Again, I knew this, but they were the only ones Halfords had that fit, and they were shitty aero blades. You know, sue me. I've ordered better ones off Autodoc and actually picked them up just before we started recording. So... Mm-hmm. That's something at least. The rear brakes had an imbalance that I have found out was I took it to a place to get the main thing that needs done doing. They were also going to sort the brakes, and they told me when they took apart the rear drums that, like, the rear shoes had no material on them at all. It was, like, metal on metal back there.
That's good.
Yeah, so new shoes, new rear slave cylinders for each side, and a brake shoe fitting kit with all the springs and clips. Actually not, like, firstly, available, which I'm quite pleasantly surprised by. Even more pleasantly surprised by, not horribly expensive. Like,
that is excellent news.
Yeah, like,
I'm shocked. I've owned much more common vehicles that have been a lot harder to get parts for in the past, so I'm surprised.
Yeah, no, shipping included from Autodoc, it was under £60 for the parts. So yeah. The main thing I found out is because Autodoc also tells you what other vehicles these parts fit.
Mm-hmm.
And although not in the exact configuration as on the 25, the basic architecture of those rear drums were used by Renault basically from the 21 and 25 all the way through to like late 90s and early 2000s vans. So
yeah, that was going to be my question, is like, just because your car's not common, I imagine there was a huge amount of parts sharing with cars that sold millions and millions and millions of units.
Exactly, yes. But I also found out that the rear shoes I have are a bit more specific to the 25, but will also fit a Suzuki Samurai.
Oh,
that's a... Wow.
That's a two-car garage.
That is, that is certainly two cars.
And I think the slave cylinders also fit some Alfa Romeos. Really? So, yeah, bizarre cross-compatibility going on there. But either way, not complaining. Not complaining overall.
Makes your life easier.
The main thing, the two things that kind of pissed me off about the MOT was they failed me on rust, which... on the one hand, not that surprising. On the other hand, kind of is, because last year it didn't even have an advisory for rust. So
it's a little perhaps suspicious, or maybe it just has rotted really quickly, but either
way. Or perhaps you didn't slip them quite enough. Did you account for inflation?
True.
But yeah, basically it's where the rear right trailing arm meets the outer sill, I think was where the it needed welding.
Okay, fine, whatever.
The reason why I think they've been a bit overzealous in diagnosing that is because they also failed me on the front power seat adjustment.
I didn't honestly realize that was mandatory. You know, you can get cars with fixed buckets. What do they do for those?
So I did know that this was a thing for reasons that are related to a story that I will tell later. But yeah, you do have to have a minimum amount of front driver's seat. It's the only seat in the car that needs to be able to move, but you do have to be able to adjust it.
Yeah, that was my thinking. Like, you know, like, oh, in order to be safe vehicle to drive, you have to be able to adjust the seat to a safe driving position and all this stuff. But what fucks me off about it was that it did move. You just had to use your front legs to help it forward a bit. So
it's getting on. Yeah. It's getting on in years. That's not fair.
Exactly. So, I am a bit annoyed that I'm pretty sure they were overzealous diagnosing the rust. Mm. A, because it didn't even have an advisory for it last year. B, because they got me on the power seat. But they don't even do welding, this place that I got the MOT test at. Cool. I had to take it to a different place to get the welding done, who are also doing the brakes and the other things that need doing on it. So, yeah, not exactly happy with that.
Yeah.
As for the power seat, I bought a can of lithium grease and just absolutely drowned the mechanism in lithium grease, like 2 days running. And to be fair, it loosened up a fair bit, loosened up quite a bit.
I'd be worried if it hadn't.
Yeah. But yeah, like it's the front power seat is now a lot happier to move backwards and forwards. So
that's good.
You know, making small progress there. I'm just the only thing I'm waiting for now, because I did the welding. The only thing I'm waiting for now is for Autodoc to actually deliver the parts I bought. Yeah. Which is always you never know how long they're actually going to take to assemble all your order, and then afterwards they give it to fucking every to deliver to you. So you know,
sometimes I think it would be quicker to go over to Germany and just pick up the parts and drive them back.
Yeah,
like even by public transport, I think you could beat it.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I've found with every that you just have, like, if you get it delivered to your door, there's a 50-50 chance almost that you're never going to see your order.
Yeah.
You just have to get it delivered to a parcel shop. So hopefully that's going to be what happens. And then the if all goes to plan, the Renault should be, hopefully, in fighting shape for Festival of the Unexceptional.
I look forward to hopefully seeing it there.
Yes. Indeed, yes. It is looking, you know, like, yeah, I'm a bit annoyed at the rust, but, you know, if it needs doing, it needs doing. And other than that, it's still continued to be in fighting shape. The fact that it does not have air conditioning from factory at all, and the blower motor broke in winter, and I only just recently managed to find a replacement blower motor sourced via the Renault 25 Owners Club in France. Big ups them. but I've yet to get it fitted. It means I've had to be doing the, you know, the 440 method of air conditioning. Four windows down, 40 miles an hour.
Yeah. And even then, on days like this, it's perhaps not enough.
Yeah.
Yeah, don't ever try to traverse the M25. That'll be the that'll be the 410 method and you'll die.
Yes. Quite. It's also just a lot of inhalation of various fumes. Unrelated to the cars, it's just like the aura that surrounds the M25, like Chernobyl. Yeah,
it stinks. It really does. Both it's physically, metaphorically, every way, really.
It's just bad.
I have been very thankful for the fact that my sunroof, by some miracle, still works on the Renault.
God fucking bless.
That is fabulous, right up until the moment it doesn't. And suddenly the problem with having a working one is that the chances of it suddenly not working while it's open are high.
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah. Again, though, I'm surprised how good the Renault 25 Owners Club is in France. They make their own replacement sunroof bracket.
Wow.
Wow. Like, that's dedication.
They have like a, whoever like they've sourced it to, or maybe they have like a big 3D printing machine, and they 3D print new like sliding brackets for the sunroof, which is absolutely astounding to me. That
I think it is truly a blessing when you have an owner's club where there's one person with enough talent, commitment, and perhaps autism.
I was about to say,
yeah. There's one key word.
Because I have a new windscreen on the way. It was supposed to arrive in May, and because of various geopolitical incidents, it is now coming in August. But it is a brand new windscreen for my Honda, and it is heated. So
yes. I remember you saying,
you know,
this.
Some guy arranged it and did a group order, and so now I'm waiting on that. But it is great when there's one person, or, you know, a few people who are committed enough to keeping these things going that you can solve these issues.
But yes, that's the update for the Renault. Things looking up, hopefully, is the general conclusion.
Yes.
Moving on to
a situation where things are looking less up. So my Honda's been, you know, it been sat at, you know, on my driveway for the past few months. I just haven't been driving it, and the MOT expired in May, and I didn't really get around to doing things. But I kind of, you know, a few weeks back, I was like, okay, well, we'll get it ready, start it, and immediately noticed that a lot more of the exhaust had crumbled out. I mean, physically crumbled out. There were bits of exhaust on the floor. So I thought, okay, well, that's definitely going to fail the MOT. I don't necessarily know about the other stuff. You know, it's had some rust advisories, but it definitely needs a whole new exhaust. As you can see in the kind of second picture there, it was I mean, I held it together with zip ties a few months ago, but those did not hold. It was bad. So I bought a whole new exhaust. Had issues with lots of stuck bolts and various issues. I ended up having to. You know a task is bad when you purchase two tools just to finish it. Oh. That's one of those things where you think, God, I wish I'd paid someone else to do this. But after the acquisition of an angle grinder and a hacksaw, got all of the exhaust off the car, because the manifold and the downpipe were completely seized together. And when they're attached, you can't pull it out the bottom because the manifold is too wide. You can't pull it out the top because the angle of the downpipe is too 90 degrees, basically. So I ended up having to slice that in half, as you can see in the top right, to pull it out. Also found a completely sheared exhaust bracket underneath the car, which you can see, and that might explain some of the rattling that the car was providing.
It would be a good place to start.
Yeah, and that is unobtainium as far as I'm aware, so I've no idea what I'm going to do about that. But I did start, today, got it all cleaned up, got my new manifold gasket on, it's a used manifold, but it's a good one. It's just basically hoping today, obviously it was very, very hot, but I thought I could try and get it all sorted, and was faced, while talking up all of the manifold bolts, a snap stud. So I've launched my wrench into the bonnet, which accomplished nothing, and basically just said, fuck it, I'm going to reassemble the rest of it, really hope it seals well enough to get through an MOT and deal with that later. So it's been a labour of love that I really wish I got somebody else to do, because obviously it's snapped inside the head as well, so I'd have to weld something onto it or drill it out. And I I really just kind of can't be asked for a car that costs £900, so I'm just hoping that by talking up all the others a little more firmly and then reattaching all the rest of it, it will get through, because I knew it wouldn't do before, but hopefully with all new pilot, I'm going to chuck a bottle of Cataclean in there or something as well and give it a good Italian tune-up before the MOT, and just really hope that this is a problem I have to deal with later rather than in about a week. But it's about 50% reassembled. I mean, I don't claim to be much of a mechanic, so it takes a while, but it's coming together. And then hopefully once that's all sorted, I fit in a new radio as well to distract myself from the misery. So
and to
I
hide the rattling.
And I can listen to banging tunes without an FM adapter that disconnects every kind of 2 minutes when you go over a bump. Yeah. So fingers crossed it will get through. I've talked with a friend, we might try and drill it out at some point, but I'm just hoping, I can always take the manifold back off, but I just want to get it through the MOT, because also if it comes up on the MOT that the rust has gotten worse, I don't think it has, but it might be outside the realm of economic sensible decision making to continue keeping this thing on the road. So we shall have to see, but I just want to get it working, not sounding like shit, and through a test, and then we'll see. Because I do like the thing, it's an endearing car, and it was only £900, so I think it deserves a bit of love, but I'm certainly not going to spend the earth on it. But it's fun. I thought the reassembly would be the easy bit, quite frankly, and I've never snapped a stud or a bolt before in my many years of wrenching on cars. I didn't think I was strong enough, to be honest with you. But yeah,
I mean, sometimes these bolts just decide, fuck you, especially at this age. I think I may have told you about it, but on the Renault, previous issue I've long since dealt with in inverted commas. It's one of those like fairly old school air filters where it's like a circular filter that sits vertically in a tube and you sort of bring open the cap. The captive bolt that held the cap in place had lost any grip it had on whatever was holding it in place. And the wing nut that was on the captive bolt had, welded via rust to the captive bolt. So,
splendid.
There was... me and a friend of mine, we drowned it in penetrating oil day after day to absolutely no effect. He used a Dremel to cut a slot in the top of the captive bolt to try and hold it in place with a screwdriver while he then wrenched on the wing nuts to try and get it off. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. eventually he just had to keep going with the Dremel and cut the entire thing in half so that we could replace my air filter. I mean, again, it's not like a head stud or a stud for the something of that variety. But
similar levels of pain. But I mean, this is completely financially stupid because I should probably just... It's a rusty old Honda, but it's endearing, so I'm hoping to get it sorted.
And it looks fully sick with the Rover wheels.
Yeah, that is basically the entire reason I bought the car is because it was advertised with Rover wheels.
That is a good choice.
And it's, you know, it's got like a full CB radio set up in there now. I absolutely love driving along just listening to truckers get angry at each other. It's free entertainment and I would recommend it to everyone. You know, it's... So I'm just hoping I can get at least another year out of it. You know, if it's got an MOT, then I can sort out little things throughout the year, but at least it's legal to drive. And it would be quite helpful to have something to put stuff and people in again, because I've been doing a shitload of miles on the MX-5 recently. I bought it August 2024 with 12,000 miles, and it is now on 41.
Oh,
whoa.
And I've done about 2,000 of those in the last, I would say, maybe 2 weeks, just going north, south, north, south. So I'd quite like to give it a break for a little while and change the fluids and stuff like that.
To be fair, if those are like, you know, roughly 20, no, yes, no, 30 something thousand motorway miles.
Yeah. It's mostly motorway, so it's not too bad, but I do miss very cushy seats with... I've got beaded seat covers on, and I understand why taxi drivers do, because it's great. It means that I never sit still enough for my back to lock in place, and then I get terrible neck pain. But hopefully, maybe with the help of a friend, I can get that sorted, and it will be at photo if I can find a nice enough MOT tester, because I really don't know, you know, it's crusty underneath, but I don't think it's bad enough to fail. It's certainly been welded about a dozen times in the past. There's like patch panels on top of patch panels and all done very cheaply, which always fills you with confidence. But I'm just really hoping I can get it sorted, because I was hoping to come today with the news that it's sorted and it's not. Yeah. But oh well, that's old cars for you.
That's what indeed. They do. They love to do that.
Speaking of, just to quickly cap that off, I will be hopefully going to Fotu with that friend of mine who helped me with the air filter, and I've helped him with various car things. He's helped me with various car things. He will hopefully be coming with his girlfriend's 2000 Hyundai Accent.
Wow!
Wow!
What
a machine!
Yeah, I think I sent a picture of it to you guys ages ago. It's two doors with a spoiler, so it's a sports car.
Wow.
That's true.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it is like piss gold.
I remember.
Yes. And it went in for its MOT on the exact same day the Renault did. It also failed, but somehow not for rust. Everyone involved was surprised it didn't fail on rust.
What did it fail on?
Yeah.
There were like a couple of other things, but the main things was the brakes.
I mean, it's a performance car. You've got to be really careful with that kind of stuff. I mean, God
exactly,
knows,
exactly.
You might be going in one of them.
Are they carbon ceramics?
60
or
70
regular?
Miles an hour.
Yeah, well, it's actually what they failed on was the active aero air brakes, actually, having the issues.
Yeah, I guess when you're going so quickly, you do need those. Those would be unsafe to be running without.
How much power does that thing push? I mean, it's got to be 65 or 70 horsepower.
No. 85.
85. Good grief. Fucking hell, you should need a special kind of license for that.
1.3 litre monster going on under the bonnet there.
Big block. Amazing.
But yes, hopefully we'll get to see that at Fotu as well.
And somehow I think my struggling with vehicles has not been the worst from the snippets I've heard.
Indeed.
So,
we now move on to the Land Cruiser.
The Land Cruiser. For the uninitiated, that is the one on the right.
I'll quickly throw up, I'll just before you get into it, I'll quickly throw up in the edit the picture I took from the side where we can see that my Renault only just comes up past the bottom of your window line.
Yeah.
Which is very entertaining to me.
Yeah, it is a silly car. I do love it a lot. I got this 80 series Land Cruiser. I've mentioned it before on the pod. I think I got it in, it would have been July 2024. So I've had it a little, nearly, almost exactly actually, 2 years. And these cars are obviously famous for their bulletproof reliability.
Oh yeah, the Toyota Wars, or all of this stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I could, if I wanted to, overthrow the government. It's a, you know, it's a good job. I'm such a well, coward.
From what I've heard from you, you probably want to at this point.
This is not a political podcast, okay?
I meant because of the car. I meant because of the car.
Andy Burnham! Allow my Land Cruiser to pass emissions tests, and my firstborn child shall belong to you.
I do have some problems with the Ministry of Transport. It doesn't really make me want to set up the British chapter of the Taliban just yet. However, if I was going to do so, I've got the right car, or at least in theory.
Mm-hmm.
So I got the petrol one because I like it. The engine's bigger.
Four
and
a half
more power.
Litre straight six petrol.
4.5 litre straight six. A whopping 200 brake horsepower from all that displacement.
Wow!
Could you imagine? Oh my goodness.
Baffles the mind.
It truly is mind-boggling. It's the most amazing thing about it, what makes it so dynamic, is that it only weighs 2.2 metric tons.
Wow. It's like a Lotus.
Basically.
Yeah.
Anyway, so as has been alluded to a couple of times, its bulletproof reliability record hasn't been my experience so far. So, some of this stuff is normal age-related things. Some of it isn't. I'll just go through what's happened in the last 8 months. Initially, it was losing oil. That's a thing that happens. I know for a fact that it loses a little bit of oil out the rear main seal because there is apparently no car manufacturer on the planet that can make a longitudinally mounted engine and transmission not lose oil at the juncture between them.
That is correct. My parents' driveway is permanently stained from my Volvo doing that. It's an impossible ask to not have that piss oil everywhere.
Yeah, it's a shame there's no way to fix this, et cetera, et cetera.
Nope.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, it's only a weep. It's not even a drip. But it started losing more oil. And I was like, well, that's probably not the rear main seal. And it needed some bushes replacing at the front. And there was oil being actively not dripped, just kind of flowing from somewhere onto them and degrading the rubber, so it wasn't worthwhile replacing them until we found the source of this oil leak. So I had a poke around. I couldn't entirely find the cause because the entire bottom of the engine was just covered in oil, and so I took it to my friends at the local Toyota garage. And it was the oil pump. The oil pump was it was fucked.
Pumping too effectively out of the car, I guess.
Yeah, it was a from inside to outside pump rather than an internal round the engine pump.
It's got the spirit.
It was trying. So that got replaced, and that was basically it. At that point, got that replaced. Ran it for a little bit, oil leak stopped, replaced the bushes, absolutely fine, all sorted. Or so I thought. We roll around to Christmas, and it is Christmas Eve. I'm driving to my parents' house. It's a relatively long distance. And there's something just not... It's cold, but there's something not quite right with the steering. It's just not... It feels heavy, but not in the car's warming up kind of way. In a kind of, I haven't really felt this before and it's actually quite mild for Christmas Eve kind of way. But I thought, it's actually fully Christmas. There's absolutely no way I'm going to get this fixed. And it's the only car I've got right now that works. So I drove it the 50 or so miles, had a lovely Christmas, and hopped back in on Boxing Day to drive back. And as I was reversing out of my parents' driveway, it was tough. And then I got it to full lock, and it made a horrendous noise. Like, oh. It sounded like someone was holding their thumb over the end of a hose and, like, holding it right up against your ear. It was this really, really loud hissing sound. It was not amazing. And I continued to use it for a little bit after that, because it was booked in to get it checked out. But it was booked in a couple of weeks away. So I was driving it. I was like, it's the power steering pump. Was the conclusion I came to. It's the power steering pump. And it did this thing for a little while where it would work fine. And then it would stop working, which is really scary. If you're in the middle of a corner and your power steering suddenly gives out while you're in the middle of turning a 2.2-ton truck, it doesn't feel amazing. The worst one, however, is when you go into a turn and it's already heavy. So you give it a lot of force and then it starts working.
Yeah.
Impromptu moose test on a British B road in a 2.2 ton truck. Not fun. Do not recommend. Anyway, it was clear that it needed to be fixed. So it finally went into the garage and they gave me a ring after taking a look and they said, yeah, we think it's the power steering pump. I said, no shit.
Really?
And they gave me an unbelievable quote for how much it would cost for them to get the part. Now, because they were actually a Toyota garage, they had to go through official channels, but they said it was going to cost them £2,000 just for the part. And I said, no,
what?
It isn't. I said, yeah, I was like, it's not. This, but by this point, it was probably late January. No, it's not going to cost £2,000. Lo and behold, I was able to get one from the Middle East, which will become relevant, for a quarter of that, which
thank God.
Was
that's
great.
Good.
That arrived. They fitted it. It worked. They replaced the belts as well because the belts were worn. It would appear that they seemed to think that it looked like the belts had maybe never been replaced, which for a 30-year-old car, that's impressive.
Yeah, but also scary.
Testament to the Land Cruiser's durability.
It does have two belts as a failsafe. They were both completely cooked. So one giving out would have almost certainly led to the failure of the other, but they survived. They survived long enough to no longer need to survive anymore. May they rest in peace.
That's what we can all hope for.
Probably
however,
multiple pieces given the degradation.
Bad news. So I got a call, and they said, we've sorted your power steering pump. I said, absolutely fantastic. When can I come and collect it? And they said, no. I said, what?
No, hangs up.
What do you mean? Have you exported it to Saudi Arabia? What's happened? And he said, no, well, something went wrong. I said, okay, what's gone wrong? And during the process of replacing the power steering pump, they had cracked the oil pump faceplate, the oil pump that's just been replaced. And so the oil pump the new oil pump had taken up the old oil pump's job pretty much exactly. Actually, more
of ejecting the oil from the vehicle.
Pumping inside to out.
Probably a lot of oil, I'd just like to add. How much oil does that thing take?
A lot. I'm pretty sure that for those 5 minutes it was running, it was pumping more than Chevron.
Birds upon... flew away in anguish.
Well, this was actually before I moved. So unfortunately, the car was in a garage in while I was moving house 150 miles. Just nightmarish stuff. Anyway, so we had to replace that plate. And would you guess, there's not a single fucking one of them in the UK. So that particular part had to be shipped from Japan.
Surely they would have paid for it, though, if they broke it.
It took a further 2 weeks. Yes, they did pay for this.
Okay, thank
God. Well, that's something.
But yeah, like the shipping time is fucking bullshit.
Really, really annoying. So that part arrives, they fit it, they run it in the garage, and it's fine. It's no longer leaking oil. But of course, you know, everything is under more stress when the car is being driven. So they had my permission, and they always have had my permission, to take it for a road test. You know, take it up through the gears, give it a rev, you know, make sure that it's fine. Yeah. It's an old car, loads of miles on it. They can drive it. It's fine. Mm-hmm. They took it out for a test drive. And the story, I wasn't there for this, but the story that I was told is that as they were pulling back into the garage, the top of the radiator exploded. Pissed coolant absolutely everywhere, as I'm sure you can imagine. Quite a lot of steam, because they'd taken it out and got it up to temperature. It was completely unfixable. Just a true obliteration of the radiator. Now, this wasn't their fault. Had I been the person to take it out for that drive, it would have happened to me. It wasn't anything they'd done wrong. They hadn't touched it. So this one was on me again. I wasn't able to find a better price than they could. So that was another £500 for the radiator. And another 2 weeks waiting for it to arrive.
Oh, my God.
So the car's been in the garage.
What month are we in now?
This would have been probably late Feb by this point. The car's been in the garage since basically the garage opened after New Year's. No, that's not quite fair. It's been in the garage since late January. So at this point, it's been in for probably about a month, maybe a touch longer. And so the radiator gets delivered, it gets fitted. Everything is fine. I mean, one of the brackets is not right, but it's fine. We're able to make it work. Mm-hmm. And it starts leaking a new fluid, because it turns out that in the time that it was just sat there, the gearbox oil cooler decided to give up the ghost. So we're really reaching territory where pretty much everything other than the block is new under the bonnet. Because, of course, I have to replace the gearbox oil cooler. I don't have a choice. And at this point, I thought, well, okay, I'm already ordering these parts. The aircon hasn't worked in the time that I've owned it. Let's do the aircon as well. Right. Mm-hmm. The front of this car has already been taken apart to an absurd degree. Let's just sort the aircon out, because then I just never have to think about this again. So I'm looking for aircon parts, and I find some parts. This will actually give a much better idea of when this was. While I was mm-hmm. looking for air conditioning parts, I go to my usual part supplier, literally while between me finding the parts and pulling together enough money to actually place the order, the US strikes Iran. Which means that I can't get those parts anymore from my supplier in the UAE. Really, really annoying. I am perhaps the most punished person on the planet by that action. And so I've got to give my business to the US instead and buy it from a US parts supplier who takes forever to get these things together. And so eventually the gearbox oil cooler and the air conditioning components arrive at the garage. By this point I've moved house a long way. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They fit them. They run it. It works. No new leaks. And they say you can come and collect the car. And I say, fantastic, I'll be there next week. And they go, really, that long? And I go, yep, in the time that you've been fixing it, I've moved really far away. So I go up, I collect the car, I pay them the... I don't have exactly how much off the top of my head, but it's nearly £3,000 in total that I owe. And that's after taking into account the fact that I bought quite a lot of the parts myself. Oh. So that doesn't include a large number of the parts. I'm into this repair for probably between £3,500 and £4,000.
Oh.
Ouch. Ouch.
Yeah.
Ouch. Okay.
Yeah.
So I collect the car and it's got basically no fuel in it. That's fine. So I pull round to the petrol station.
Don't tell me there's another fluid.
No,
it's not,
no, no. If you say this is leaking more fluid, I am telling you this car is cursed. You need to get rid
of
it.
Because at this point, you're just running through the bingo list. The only liquid it hasn't leaked is your blood, which it shall soon draw because it is desperate for your death.
I think at this point, Fred would give his blood to not have it do this anymore.
I would. I don't know how much I can afford to lose, but I'd give it 10% more. So thankfully it doesn't leak a new fluid when I take it to the petrol station. It's one that it's already leaked before. So at least we're on familiar ground. I pull into the petrol station and there's a guy, this happens quite a lot because these cars are quite rare. People quite like them and mine's in quite good nick. So a guy comes, I fill it up with fuel. I go in. I come back out. I'm looking at other cars in the petrol station. I go to open the driver's door, and a guy who's parked at a pump next to me comes over and he goes, "That's a nice car. How much did you pay for it?" And I go, I tell him it wasn't a huge amount of money. He goes, "Oh, you've got a great deal on that. It looks in great nick. Looks like it's been running hot though." And I go, "You what?" And he points, and underneath is a large puddle of what is very clearly coolant. Oh. And I go, "That's funny that. It's not been running hot. I've driven it about 0.3 miles. In fact, I'm going to point over the road. That's the garage I just drove it from." And he goes, "Well, should we take a look under the bonnet and see what's going on?" I go, "No, I actually know what's going on." But he insisted. So we opened the bonnet and he had a fiddle around. We were just chatting about the car. It's always nice to talk to people who are interested and care. Mm-hmm. But his verdict was the one that I had already reached, which was that it was coolant, would you believe?
Was it really?
The car had no coolant in it at this point. Thankfully, the drive to the garage was about 0.3 miles. So I drove it straight back. Bearing in mind, I had nowhere to stay here, nor any other way of getting home.
I think there are very few situations where it is acceptable to walk into a place of, you know, a business and immediately demand to see the manager. I think you may have one, to be honest with you.
I went in and I found that I've been dealing with the same service guy for the... the entire time that I've owned the car. Great
guy.
I bet
his stomach dropped.
He was not pleased to see me. He had the face of pure... Because I've just given these guys £3,000 and I'm back 10 minutes later. The look of fear on his face was unreal.
He paid £3,000 not to be in that situation at that
point. I bet he really wishes he'd taken a sick day. So I pull back in and it's still dripping. And so, you know, he's like, "Okay, we're gonna get this in now and fix this." And thankfully, it turns out that they had replaced the radiator, but they hadn't replaced one of the rubberized hoses, which was quite old and had been stretched out by the old radiator, and one Jubilee clip wasn't enough to keep it clipped to the new radiator inlet. So it was just pissing out. So now it has two Jubilee clips and it's absolutely fine. So that got fixed. It did take a little while, but I was able to get home that same day in my now almost entirely brand new 1996 Toyota Land Cruiser. I feel that the mileage on the odometer should be less to compensate for the fact that none of it is that old.
you can scrub a digit off. I think that's fair. I think you're allowed.
So unfortunately, it doesn't end. I got it back, and it was this was I think I moved in mid-March. So I got it, and I delayed moving for a week in the hope that I'd get the car, and it didn't end up happening. So I think I ended up getting the car back in late March, and it was due for its MOT in mid-April. Mm-hmm. And so I took it for its MOT at a local garage here. And normal stuff, seatbelt fraying as an advisory, some play in the steering, would you believe I know about
that? Does it really?
Just a touch. Only about 25 or 30 degrees. But it failed on emissions. Mm-hmm. I thought, that's weird. The garage rang me and they said, yeah, it's failed its MOT on emissions. And I go, okay, have you got any idea why? And they said, no, and the car's actually too big to get into the garage itself. We tested it out on the street. You'll have to take it somewhere else. And I go, I did specifically ask before I brought it here, you know what, it's fine. So
the reason it actually failed the MOT is like a bus broke down and like was standing still and just like pissing diesel fumes in the direction of your car while they were testing it.
I wish. Mm. So I took it to another garage, on their recommendation, and they retested just the emissions. They didn't do a whole other MOT test because they wanted to see if it would pass first. Credit to them for that. It already has one fail on its record. I don't need a second one. Thank you. And it failed again on emissions. And I thought this was really weird because it's never done this before. It's never been a problem. And I saw on the MOT testing certificate and the emissions testing printout that I got that they tested it as a same year, 1996, 4-litre Land Cruiser Colorado. Now, this shouldn't really be a problem. I asked why they did it, and they said, well, your car didn't appear in the system. We get given a drop-down menu of cars with the information that we've got, and yours simply wasn't there, so we picked the closest one. And I thought, okay, I've actually seen this before. The garage that I took it to previously, which was a Toyota garage, often had it listed as a 2.8 litre diesel Invincible from a decade after it was produced, because it's the only car that they've got on the system. It's the only model that's there, which is not amazing, but it's never really been a problem before. And, you know, this Colorado, also a petrol, same year, shouldn't be a problem. But it failed its emissions by a lot, a significant margin. Almost as though it was being tested to the wrong standards.
Really?
And I thought, well, that's strange. And the first thing I did is I got in touch with the previous garage to see if I could get an emissions report from last time it had its MOT test to compare, to see if the car's emissions have actually changed or if there is a problem with the testing. They said, no, we only keep those for 3 months. Well, that's not fucking helpful, is it? But you know what? That's fine. If it's gone, it's gone. We're going to find a way around it. So I booted up I can't remember the name of the document. This was a couple of months ago now, but it was the Ministry Transport Handbook for Emissions Testing Volume, whatever. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
To really get an idea of what was going on. And it turns out that my car was produced at exactly the wrong time for this kind of issue to occur. So, Euro 2, which is a European Emission Standards 2 for anyone outside of Europe, was introduced in January of 1996. Now,
yes,
that is before my car was registered. My car was registered in August 1996. However...
My car was as well, actually. I've got my V5 here. Yeah, mine is as well.
Huh. There you go.
However, for cars with more than six seats or commercial vehicles, Euro 2 standards didn't need to be met until January of 1997. Now, I thought I'd found what the problem was. My car has eight seats, so it's been tested to Euro 2, despite being built for Euro 1. Pretty easy fix. So I go, well, why has it been tested to Euro 2? It's probably because the model is wrong. They've probably tested it to the only car they got in the drop-down menu is a 4-litre Colorado from the same year. It must have less seats. And I check, and it doesn't. That also has eight seats. So I'm back to square one. I'm like, it's been tested as a petrol Land Cruiser from 1996 with eight seats. Why has it been tested to Euro 2 standards? And I spent an entire day going through this enormously long and dense document, and I found it. So it turns out that for the model year 1996, there was several hundred individual models that existed outside of the normal parameters for Euro 1 and Euro 2 testing. Mm-hmm. And the Land Cruiser Colorado that my car was being tested as was one of them. It didn't technically need to meet Euro 2 standards. However, Toyota elected to build it to Euro 2 standards, and therefore it was tested to Euro 2 standards. So I now had my culprit. It was being tested as a Euro 2 car, despite only needing to meet Euro 1 regulations.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's all well and good, but how the fuck do we fix it? Because my car isn't in the MOT system. And
how is it tested before? Like, it must have been an update to the system or something.
I genuinely have no idea. That is the one part of this that I have not been able to get to the bottom to, is how has this not been a problem for the last 30 years?
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't. It was a problem this time. And I basically took all of this paperwork that I had to the garage and I said, look, you're testing this car to the wrong standards. I don't know what you have to do to test it to the right standards. But if you need to justify this to the DVSA, here's all of the paperwork that you'll need to do it. And they go, all right, leave it with us. And they test it to Euro 1. Of course it passes because there's nothing wrong with the car. And then finally it's done. It has an MOT. Nothing on it is currently broken. Touch all of the available wood. And I'm able to use it.
There's a lot of wood in there to touch, to be fair.
Well, wood effect.
No, well, close enough. You see,
it's the thought that counts, surely.
That's got me perhaps a little apprehensive, because I was sorting out some paperwork earlier, so I have the V5 for my Honda here. Please tell me why it doesn't have anything written under the Euro status. Wait, maybe that's good.
Yours will be Euro 2, because it was...
It's August 22nd of August 1996, but it doesn't have anything written under the Euro status, so maybe they won't test it. So well, I guess it depends on the system, but if they don't test it to Euro 2, I might actually have an MOT.
Fingers crossed for you.
I'm lucky in that because I think my Renault is 1989, and I think Euro 1 came into effect in 1991.
Yeah.
So I might even be in a position where I don't have to worry about any emissions at all.
Yeah, for cars that old, it's just whether it has visible smoke or not.
Yeah, you still have to meet. But they were so lax. I mean,
exactly.
Yeah,
even Euro 1 is pretty
Euro 1
lax.
Is incredible. Like the difference between Euro 1 and Euro 2, as I found out, Euro 2 cars are expected to have less than a third of the carbon monoxide and particulate emissions of Euro 1. It was a really, really heavy clamp down.
But anyway, the the Land Cruiser woes say that multiple times as fast. Jesus Christ.
Yeah, just know that if that car doesn't make it to Festival of the Unexceptional, I am hanging from a bridge, because there is absolutely no scenario in which anything on it is allowed to go wrong now. It would just be I don't even know what's left that could possibly go wrong. I don't really want to think about it or know. The amount of time and money that it has taken.
Like, legitimately, something horribly, brutally mechanical would have to throw shrapnel everywhere. That's the only thing that could possibly top things at this point.
I don't want to know. I don't want to know. It's fine. It's running absolutely fine. I'm so kind to it. I run it on premium fuel, even though I absolutely don't have to. I check the oil level literally every single time I drive it. It's extremely well taken care of. Please, Toyota gods, please let it live.
Please. I'm beginning to believe. Right, well, with the Land Cruiser saga over and done with, it sounds like a sort of Dune-esque sort of story of various generational leaders
and generational debt as well, really.
Yes, indeed.
Don't remind me.
I
am
on.
Capital One's strongest soldier.
We move on to the actual news, and like we have to talk about the Luce. There's no way we can beat around the bush. We have to talk about the Luce.
What were they thinking?
Who wants to go first?
Yeah, I mean, where do we even start? Like,
I don't have a problem with the car. It's just not Ferrari. Like,
it's so aggressively anti-Ferrari.
Yeah, and like, I just don't understand, really.
It's not it being electric.
No.
Like, Ferrari Ferrari had to make an electric car at some point. Yeah. Like, that's the nature of the industry that they're in. Mm-hmm. You can't be mad at them for that. Like, no. Whatever. But I'm not angry. It's a four-door. Not angry it's a four-door, because I think Ferrari, I mean, because was the Pura Sangue was a four-door, wasn't it? And as I think a four-door saloon is a better move than a four-door SUV.
Saloon
Ferrari.
Is generous.
Yeah, it's a four-door blob. But,
I was going to say those exact words.
Yeah. But, you know, back in the 80s, you had the Ferrari Pinin concept, and that thing it looked fantastic.
Yeah.
So, you know, Ferrari, in its nature, is not sort of axiomatically opposed to a four-door. I think that's perfectly fine. It's just this.
Yeah.
This.
No.
It is quite baffling. I had, as I think everyone did, quite a quick and highly negative reaction to this when I first saw it. Which I will say, having had some weeks now to let it kind of settle down, let the immediate reaction kind of boil off a little bit, I have softened slightly, very slightly on
it. Yeah, I don't hate the design, but if it was
I don't love it.
If it was a Lucid, I would say, yeah, that makes sense. But
makes
it
sense.
Would make
fucking
sense.
Ferrari
it would still
badge
not
on
be
it.
Very good looking.
No, true,
it
but
still
it wouldn't
be
a
good looking
but
thing.
Just, I think the main
it would
reason
be baffling.
That I... It's just because it's that with a Ferrari badge. It doesn't make any sense to me.
It's everything. It's the price. It's the whole.
That's the other thing. The price. How much does it cost again?
It's like over $600,000.
Yeah, in Europe, it's going to cost €550,000.
Yeah, it's just really absurd. Like, this should be Like, even this car without any changes, if this slotted in right at the bottom of Ferrari's lineup, it would still be slightly offensive.
Yeah.
The fact that they've slotted it in above, I mean, what do you have to pay for? I don't know what Ferrari's lineup
this
looks
like.
This
is more like than the Dodici Cilindri, or if I vaguely even got that right. This is going to be more than that, surely. Yeah.
I mean, I'm not sure it's more than that, because that's like a mega halo car. But I mean, you could buy 3 Romas for that. I mean, it's just, maybe you couldn't actually. Maybe they've upped the price on the Romas, but it's a lot. You could buy at least 2 Romas for that.
No, you could. You could buy a 12 cylinder. On the road prices start at 339.
Wow. So you could almost buy 2.
You could buy 1.5
flagship
at the very least, yeah.
GT car for the price of one of the, and the it just doesn't have anything to justify it. If they'd had some mega battery breakthrough, if it was incredibly powerful, if it was like forward looking in terms of what electric race car tech is going to look like in the future, because Ferrari likes to kid themselves that they're a racing company that makes road cars to fund it. They haven't been that for a very long time, but they like to pretend that they are. If they'd done that with this, I could maybe force myself to
accept its existence.
Not like it would be too far.
But yeah, Ferrari have long, long since become a lifestyle brand.
It's not even.
Yeah, they have,
for
but
that.
This doesn't fit into that lifestyle. I mean, maybe it does, right? Because the way that they're going to sell these, and we know this, I don't have a relationship with Ferrari, nor am I really particularly an automotive journalist. I don't feel like I'm at risk of getting sued, as some people have suggested allegedly Ferrari like to do.
Yeah.
But the way that they're selling these ultimately is that they are probably allegedly making it clear to their existing customers that future halo cars that people want will be offered to those who buy these.
I've seen some reports of that. Yes,
it's so for Ferrari. They're not going to get their comeuppance. They can't get it wrong enough.
Well,
for as long as they have halo cards,
unless the entire stack of cards falls down. You're right. No, it's that, you know, you're going to see them very occasionally, and when you see one, you're going to think, wow, I bet that person has a much better vehicle in their garage than this, you know?
You say that, but I do think they'll be more careful in the future because of one simple thing. On the day that this was announced, Ferrari's stock price went down 8.4%.
That is true. I did see that. However, has it recovered?
I haven't seen if it's recovered. I would say it probably has. I would guess that it probably has recovered. But even still, you don't... If you can avoid that again, because that doesn't happen. That doesn't happen to any other company, certainly any other car company. A near 10% drop in stock price overnight. If you can avoid that again, you're going to, right?
It has more than recovered, by the way.
I'm not exactly shocked by that, but that's the kind of thing as a business that you want to avoid, and I think it will probably make them a bit more careful around certain things like this in the future. I do have a few things I need to get out of the way. Firstly, though, this looks like a designer sandal. This looks like an accessory for the Nintendo Wii. This looks like a Bluetooth speaker.
It looks like a car mouse that you'd have in the 2000s.
Yes,
oh, it
exactly.
Does.
Yeah. And there is a reason. There is a reason for a lot of that.
It's Apple, isn't it?
It is. It is vaguely Apple, yes. So the design for the exterior and interior of this were designed in collaboration with a company called Love From, one word with a capital F.
Right.
Love From was founded by Johnny Ive and Mark Newsom. Johnny Ive, famous for designing the iPod and the iMac, and yeah. Mark Newsom, famous for designing the first generation Apple Watch.
So they can, but that kind of forward thinking, you know, design in terms of like, oh, it's, you know, that kind of design language is in no way compatible with Ferrari. I don't understand.
No, this is the problem. It's not even that they shouldn't be delving into the realm of automotive design if they want to. It's just Ferrari is as far from an appropriate collaboration partner as it is possible to imagine. I mean, can you think of a more sexless accessory than the first generation Apple Watch? It might be the least sexy thing a person can wear.
It's funny, actually, because this isn't Mark Newson's first delve into car design. He also, back in 1999, at least had a hand in designing the Ford 021C concept. Which,
I did see this, yes.
Which I will flash up on screen right now in the edit. And if I'll quickly also put this in the Discord chat so that you guys can have a look at it.
That's helpful because my Firefox just crashed.
Right. But yeah, oh. There you go.
But you see, that thing's quite charming. I quite like that.
But
it's just that car is a little guy.
Yes. It's a guy who, like, he kind of speaks like this, and he's bouncing around, and he's, oh, look at me, I'm a funny little green thing. Like,
again, though, remarkably and totally sexless.
Yes,
I mean,
exactly,
it's charming,
yeah.
But sexless. And that's just not what Ferrari... I can see it working for a little, like, a little Ford thing.
Yeah.
That's quite cute. But for a Ferrari, I mean, my goodness, it's just deeply wrong.
Again, but, like, the whole point with this exercise is... what it looks like from the perspective of the people behind this, what it looks like doesn't matter. What matters is we got From Love to design this. They're like a forward-thinking tech company. They've got big minds behind them. They designed the car. That's what's important
to
the people behind this.
But how did they arrive at that conclusion is what's baffled me. Because it's that's clearly true, right? Clearly the... you know, the higher ups at Ferrari were like, okay, we're going to do this new thing. We're going to be forward looking, future electricity technology. Okay, we'll get some of the most like successful industrial designers in the world to design our new car. I can see how they took the mental steps to get there, but it's like, they all simultaneously forgot the company that they run.
Yeah.
Ferrari isn't about this kind of cold technological progress that Apple is. Ferrari is about romance. It's about nostalgia. It's about sex appeal. And this just is so divorced, so thoroughly divorced from any of that.
It's sort of an exercise in showing how, like, ghoulish and completely lacking in any personality and humanity people are at the top of big corporations and companies. Because surely they should have just been able to look at this and realize it was wrong and bad. But no, as you say, it made it through all the processes and it's getting to production. Cough up $500,000, please.
Yeah.
It's, my controversial take on the Luce is not that I think it's good. It's that I am absolutely convinced that it will be a classic.
Mm.
As like a sort of quirk of Ferrari's history years down the line.
I don't want to hear that. I really don't want to hear that.
I really think just because of the magnitude of reaction to it, like, I mean, Ferrari has had this problem over the last few years that their cars have struggled to make people feel anything at all.
Well, they're certainly feeling something.
Exactly. This is creating a feeling amongst even people who really don't give a shit about cars, right? Most of that feeling is negative, but it doesn't really matter? I mean, in when this thing's been out of production for 20, 25 years, what a piece of intrigue this would be at a car show. Could you imagine going to a classic car show and one of these shows up? I mean, it would be getting swarmed. Because they're probably not going to sell very many of them, are they? Right? Two, it's such an oddity.
Yeah.
Already.
Almost like the Pontiac Aztec effect.
Except the Pontiac Aztec is remembered fondly, but it isn't reflected in values. These are going to crater in value almost instantaneously. Oh, yeah. But I reckon in 25 years' time, these will be £1 million cars.
Oh, I hate it, but
I don't know million. I was with you. I was kind of following along. I was interested in where you were going until you said a million.
I think they will be.
I don't know about that. I don't know about that.
Time will tell, but it depends how many of them they sell. Right.
I mean, eventually it'll be worth a million because of inflation, but
if they really don't, I mean, I don't know how many they're planning to sell at that kind of price. I imagine it's not very many. If they ship less than 2,000 of these, I mean, it's almost guaranteed. It's just laws of economics. It's going to, the prices are going to explode once people start to be far enough away that the visceral hatred has dissipated and it becomes kind of a quirky thing, right?
Mm.
Yeah. I mean, I'd just like to, I've only just noticed that the wipers are sideways. What's that all about?
Yeah, it stores the wipers at the top.
It's just such a baffling piece of design, and I really don't understand why it has a Ferrari badge on it. And there are some bits of it that I do actually quite like. I like the wheels. I think they're quite nice. I like
I could have picked the picture with they were quite proud of the other set of wheels that came on it, and they were absolutely hideous.
Normally I would like that sort of thing. No. But the interior is really nice. It's not perfect. It's, you can see the kind of the Apple influence in it. But, you know, the steering wheel I think looks good. I like the fact that it's got, you know, separate actual, you know, they're, you know, screens, but it's got actual gauges rather than just being one big screen. I like that. It looks quite premium in there, but I just don't understand why it's a Ferrari. Yeah.
I don't know if I could agree with the interior looks like it's out of an SUV. The interior almost looks like it should be in a Rivian to me personally.
Well, that's the thing. This whole thing should be a Rivian.
Or a Lucid or something like that. Yeah.
Some other, you know, kind of quirky, we're modern, you know, we do things differently sort of electric car manufacturer. And I would understand.
Center screen in the interior literally just looks like they dragged an Apple Watch bigger in Photoshop and just slapped it on there.
Don't get it as a Ferrari. I cannot understand how this got all the way through to be... I'm sure people did say something, but it just seems
that they got overruled.
Yeah, I simply don't understand it. And it's, it probably will one day be remembered as this was quirky, you know, and the price, I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, what does it have that other electric cars with similar performance that cost a sixth of the amount don't have?
A Ferrari badge. That's it. Worse in a number of ways. It doesn't have particularly good range. It doesn't have a particularly impressive amount of power. What does it have? I mean, it's got a Ferrari badge. It's got the weight of a corporation behind it, leaning on their wealthiest customers to buy it effectively under duress.
Yeah.
And that's it.
It baffles me, really. I mean, if you told me that this was like a new, even I could believe that this would be a new Lotus saloon, electric saloon.
Mm.
You know, it has the kind of same general shape as the Electra or whatever it is.
Yeah, the Electra looks almost, at least it has angles.
Yeah.
At least it has sharp edges. It's trying to do something.
Oh, I'm so confused. And I want to keep talking about it, but I think I'd be saying the same three things again and again. I just don't get it.
This front quarter view as well, by the way, that we've got up here, is the most flattering angle of this car.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, if you take a rear three-quarter view or a look at the back, it does look remarkably awkward and tall and weird.
Especially with the solid turbine wheels that they were trying to show it off with initially. Those on like a perfect side-on shot make it look really weirdly tall.
I only just realized it has suicide doors. What?
Yeah.
So they're doing that. They're bringing that back. Oh,
I mean, suicide doors make it something. That's something interesting. I kind of like suicide doors, but like, hello?
Yeah, I just don't.
The sides of the car are so flat, and there's nothing going on at all. Yeah. It's got the classic big black section at the bottom to try and make it look like
lithe.
It does this thing, and I know I've talked about it with a bunch of cars, but look how much car is above the rear wheel. It's silly.
It is absolute, like, from the rear three-quarter, it does just look exactly like a Lucid Air. Pretty much exactly like a Lucid Air.
Oh, God. Yeah, I just don't understand how this has got all the way to a production ready car with a Ferrari badge on it. I would understand its purpose if it was not a Ferrari. Well, I mean, I understand its purpose in terms of, you know, it will be used to sell other cars, but
it will probably also be used to meet like fleet emissions targets.
It's my best guess. It's a good point, actually, but just disappointing to see. You know, at least the Pura Sangue or whatever it is, that's a fucking V12 up there, and it looks like a Ferrari.
The biggest fan of Ferrari's current design language, right, amongst their sports cars.
Me neither.
Even if they had done the same running gear and just abided by their own existing design language, it would have been a non-event.
I think that's a good point. By trying to turn it into an event, because they had like there's always going to be a press launch, but they really tried to make it, seems like they tried to make a fairly big deal out of this.
Well, they made a big deal out of it, and they also were like, again, allegedly exercising an unusually tight hold on
repeat
reporting.
Customers. Oh, sorry, right, yeah, reporting, yeah.
People who went to the event, and this is my own view, is that reporters who went to the event were usually a lot more neutral in their language than those who didn't.
Yeah.
Yes. I think that's more than fair to say. But as a sort of attempt, maybe, to console car people, to attempt to win back some vague shape of faith, they announced that there's going to be a manual version of the 12-cylindry.
Yeah.
Yeah. I saw a Dodici Talindre on the road recently. I know, being on the M25, it really does.
Oh,
you see a lot of cars.
I just meant being able to pronounce it, to be honest.
Yes.
Oh, right. I saw it. It was going northbound, and it wasn't in traffic, and I was very jealous, mostly of the lack of traffic more than the car. But I actually thought, because in pictures, it looks fine. I actually thought in the flesh, it looked quite good. It was quite a nice looking thing on the road.
Yeah. I think the Dodici I tried it and failed instantly. The 12-cylindry and the Roma, I think, are the two best looking cars that Ferrari make right now.
Mm-hmm. I'm not actually a huge fan of the Roma, personally.
It's a bit plain, but there's almost like an elegance in the fact that it's quite clean in its lines, for me personally. But
I think this is better.
Yeah.
I could go either way. I have, I think the general shape of this is better, but also there are tiny little details in it that kind of throw things off for me. But either way, I still think it's a good looking thing, fairly good looking thing overall. But yeah, they're making a manual version of it, which again I think
is
funny that it's coming out around the same time as the Lucha.
Yeah, it's a manual with an asterisk, isn't it?
It is. It's a couple of asterisks. The most, I mean, you know, we were talking about price of the Lucha. Do you know how much extra they're charging for this manual?
I do not know.
$150,000.
Kill yourself. What are you... Hello? What?
Jeez.
It's one of the most expensive optional extras I'm aware of on any car ever. Now, someone will be putting together a top 10 list of the most expensive car options in history, and I congratulate you on the 5,500 views that video is going to get. But, like, this is ridiculous.
That is disgusting. And on top of that, you know, like the... Yeah. Sorry, continue.
As Robin alluded to, it is not just a manual. In fact, it's not really a manual at all.
Well, just because it's, as far as I'm aware, it's the same gearbox that it has previously, but with, you know, instead of normally you pull the paddles, instead it converts the position of the gear shifter and the position of the clutch into simulating it being a manual, but I presume with a lot of safety things put in so that you can't stall it or, you know, misshift or something. But it is basically just the original, you know, dual clutch gearbox that was in the car, but hooked up to what is ostensibly a Logitech G920 shifter that is sitting in your car. And, you know...
Yeah.
I mean, it's always this.
They're calling
kind of,
it shift by wire.
Yeah, this kind
of phrase that I've seen.
Way of doing it, you know, a transmission like that is always something I've been a little curious about in terms of, like, you know, what says that you can't do that and why would it be bad? But to charge, well, what is it, $150,000 for it seems a little cheeky. I mean,
cheeky.
I feel compelled, I can't, the price is totally indefensible. I feel compelled to defend the premise.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of anti-Ferrari, it's extremely easy to have anti-Ferrari sentiment in the current climate. The Luce's just launched, they are clearly morphing themselves into a soulless, vapid, wealth-draining operation of truly biblical proportions, and the impact that that's going to have on their brand image going forward is immeasurably bad, in my opinion, of course. Mm. However, when Koenigsegg did this same concept with the CC850 a few years ago, I really thought it was very cool, and I still think it's cool.
Yeah, I would agree.
Part of the reason that it was cool with the CC850, and I don't actually know what the status of the kind of safety stuff is on the Ferrari. I know Koenigsegg did allow you to stall it, for example.
Yeah.
Like you could get it wrong, which I think makes it feel more like an event.
Yeah.
And, you know, the fact that it isn't a purely mechanical linkage does presumably mean they can do things like really dial in the feel to make it as satisfying as possible, because it doesn't have to do anything other than feel satisfying.
Yeah.
And you know, in a world that is trying so hard to insulate us from doing things of any kind, a car that, you know, makes you do something totally useless simply because it's fun and enjoyable, I kind of like. I can kind of get behind it. I can't get behind it as $150,000.
Yeah, I'm similar sentiment
absolutely
here.
Absolutely nuts.
It's an idea I've, you know, it was the kind of thing that I thought of as a kid. They'd be like, oh, that'd be cool if you could have a manual, but it's not a manual because, but I just, for that price, I would love to, you know, funny enough, Ferrari, I'd love to have a go in it so I could better form my opinions. But
yes,
in the meantime, I have to stick with the opinion that I think it's cool, but $150,000? I mean, my one thought is that maybe this is their kind of initial test run. They put it as a really expensive option on this, and if customers like it, then it becomes a, you know, maybe a smaller cost option for other vehicles in their lineup, which I would like to see. But as it stands with the information we know now, Jesus Christ, guys, you can't be doing that.
Yeah, it's really rough. I mean, I'm gonna second that. I mean, if we want to do a hot air outtake 11 live from Maranello Ferrari, please feel free to reach
yeah,
out.
Yeah, I don't know if we're gonna get that after what we said about the Luce.
Yeah, I mean, I'd drive one of those as well if you give me the keys.
Yes, I'm prepared to completely change my opinion.
Mm-hmm. If you pay me enough, I will change my mind.
Oh, yeah. I'm so easily swung by financial incentives.
It doesn't, by your standards, Ferrari, it wouldn't even be that much.
Yeah.
Yes.
It would be less than the price of a gearbox.
I think you could send all three of us for this experience for less than the price of a gearbox. So just think about that, guys.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm as fully on board with the sort of simulated shifting thing. There's just a part of my brain that has a fascination with like how mechanical things work, and that I don't think I can take out fully. I can obviously appreciate, like, you know, all of the sentiments about how it's still like, if the feeling's there, then in the moment it doesn't really matter, but my brain
it
likes...
is still an interesting mechanism, though.
Yeah, absolutely. Right? Yeah. But like, my brain likes, you know, thinking about metal gears smashing into each other and this kind of crap. I'm entirely juvenile
you're,
in that respect.
No, you're so real for that.
But yeah, I mean, you guys have already said it. Why are we charging? Again, like, race sim rigs exist. People have them. They use force feedback to simulate shifting, to simulate steering, even things that this gearbox option isn't simulating. You can buy a top of the line sim racing rig for under £10,000. What the fuck are we doing with $150,000?
Yeah,
I've got absolutely no idea how they're justifying that. It's an addition to a car that already existed. So I could see 25.
Yeah. Like with the Ferrari premium, with like the Ferrari premium pricing.
And I think
like that's what you pay for extras. Yeah, I can see 25.
And I think that is only really acceptable if you are actually able to blow up the engine by not changing gear.
Yeah.
Which is the only, like, if it really is too careful with itself, I'm less on board. But yeah, I mean... how much did you say that these cars were selling for new? I mean, we're talking about what is between a 30% and 50% markup, right?
Yeah. So on the road price for one of these is basically like $339,450.
I mean, that's just insane.
Yeah.
What, like on what?
It's nearly a 50% markup. Yeah.
On what planet does that make any sense?
And the thing that's also just putting in perspective for me is you can go out and buy, you know, a 599 that's an automatic and have it converted, fully converted to a manual for a hell of a lot less than $150,000. I mean, yes, it's expensive, but you could literally have, you know, some company take out, you know, put a proper gated shifter in there, give you a clutch pedal, all of that. Transfer the, you know, single clutch automatic to a manual for less than $150,000. And what have they added? They've added a bit of metal, a clutch pedal that feeds into a sensor somewhere, and then the software for it. I don't get it. Yeah.
New models, for a hard top, you look at 395k euros.
395. I mean,
with so, no, I presume that's with no extras. That's just like, you
sure,
know.
But that actually places the markup even higher than we've been talking about. It's the manual is set to be a 1,499 car limited run with prices starting at 590,000 euros.
So that's nearly 200,000
euros. Nearly 200,000 euros.
That's 195,000 euros.
That's the that's closer to $250,000.
I'm fucking
bloody hell.
Fuck.
Fuck me.
I mean, obviously, once the base car's got some options on it, it, you know, the hundred. I see where the 150k came from, but fuck me.
That's fucking absurd, man.
Is there just infinite money in the world now, and nobody told me about it?
Well, I mean, if you bought Nvidia stock 10 years ago, yes.
True. I have 16 terabytes of storage, so maybe I can get myself one.
Yeah, I mean, if you kind of rate at which those prices are increasing, contract values keep going up. In a couple of years' time, you'll be able to buy, it'll probably just be the gearbox, but you would be able to get the gearbox if you sell your RAM.
Yeah, that's fine.
And your storage.
So what's now?
Yeah, we'll talk about this. So,
oh, good God. Have we got any good news?
If there was an episode, I'm not sure if it was the last one or the one before that, but we were talking about the Mercedes-AMG Concept XX and how it had broken a bunch of records and it had a look to it. A look that we disagreed on. I thought it was all right. I wouldn't have been mad seeing it on the road. Mm-hmm. It just, if only just because it was a bit distinctive. It had a bit of a fish mouth on it. Other than that, it was fine. The production version of it has been unveiled.
It's
now,
and it looks like quite that. Fishy. It's looking a bit fishy.
It looks the same amount of fishy, but they've Mercedes because they did this with the electric. Was it the electric CLA class or GLA or the extra something or other? They seem to have been adopting this unique Mercedes own version of the full length light bar at the front, which firstly. You know, firstly, just don't do a full width light bar at the front. Everyone's doing it and none of them are good. I'm sick to death of all of them. Mercedes seem to be doing this unique approach where they take their existing design language and just paint the light bar on across the bonnet without making any changes to the bonnet line, to anything. You just, like, what if we just connected the two headlights that were already there?
It looks, this is not complimentary, but it is, I feel it is true. It looks like a basking shark with a weak chin and a monobrow.
Yeah.
Like that is what I imagine their, like, collage of inspiration was, you know, what if we designed a car around a remarkable genetic reject of the basking shark species.
Yeah, if you hold, it's bizarre to me because it's so, none of it works together. If you hold your hand up to your screen and cover the Mercedes fish mouth, that
happily
looks, yeah, what I'm looking at when I do that, it looks almost like some weird like cross of a Porsche Panamera and an Aura cat.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, it does.
It looks, yeah. It's a very, very Chinese looking design, really. You could put a Zika badge on it, and I believe it.
Yeah, we've met Mercedes at a very Chinese time in their life, yes.
We've met the whole car industry at a very Chinese
well, indeed,
time.
Yes.
Yeah. Like, we'll be talking about that shortly.
Yes, but yeah, it's all clashing. It completely clashes. The elements don't really work amazingly in isolation, and together they become so much less than the sum of their parts.
It's just awful.
Yeah.
It's everything wrong with, like, current car design from, and I don't know what it is. It is particularly the German makes. Just keep doing this. Like, horrible, horrible big slab sides, round, like, this
huge,
really
gaping mouths
mix of, like, like curvy sides, and then they try to do some angular stuff. God really knows why. Just pick one. At least Audi pick one. I think Audi go a little bit too hard on the angles, right? But at least they know what they're trying to do. Mercedes and BMW, they just keep doing these weird incongruous mixes of too many different things. It's got a whopping great gaping mouth. It's just horrible.
It's really, really not good, no. But what's funny to me is I can't remember whether this was unveiled just before or just after the Luce, but either way, these were announced at very, very similar times. And I just remember thinking, Mercedes are thanking their lucky stars that the Luce came out at the same time and took all of the heat off them. which is where we come in, because we're not letting them get away with it. We do proper journalism here. But yeah, this thing, and like, you know, because underneath it's just going to be a, you know, another ludicrously powerful, ludicrously heavy electric nonsense underneath. Like, oh, what are you looking at me for? You know, like, it's...
Yeah.
It really does look, because what's kind of baffling about this, and it's slightly baffling about Porsche as well, right? When the original Panamera came out, there was not a single person who thought or expressed the opinion that it was a pretty car. It wasn't, right? No one bought it thinking that it was a pretty car. People bought it in spite of the way that it looked, because in every other regard, it was a good car, right? It just happened to be pig ugly.
Yeah.
And so you think that if you're going to try and follow a formula similar to that, if you're going to try and create a big luxury four-door, you know, fastback type coupe saloon thing, you'd think, you'd go, well, why don't we take all the good bits of the Panamera, you know, the speed, the usability, the comfort, you know, all of these things, and we could win this market segment by packaging it in a body that looks nice. You'd think someone over the course of the last 15 years would have had that thought, and apparently not a single fucker in Germany has had that occur to them at any point. They just keep getting fucking uglier.
The Panamera,
the Taycan looks good.
The Panamera did start looking better as the generations went on. I'm not saying it looks great by any means. But the thing for me is that the Taycan did it as well. The main reason they managed to achieve that was by eliminating some of the practicality. The whole point why the Panamera looked, the first gen one looked a bit like sort of dog taking a shitty, was because Ferdinand Piëch was a tall motherfucker, and he demanded that he be able to sit comfortably in the back. Mm-hmm. With the later versions of the
make
Panamera
it an estate. Which they did with the Taycan Cross Turismo. In fairness, they did with the Taycan Cross Turismo, and that is a good-looking car, right? But that's not this market segment. That is a different thing. That is an estate, which is what the Panamera always should have been.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, bring back shooting brakes, for the love of God, firstly.
Yes.
but, yeah, this just... it's absolutely astounding that... Like, we seem to have arrived at the exact same, well, again, maybe not the exact same issue, but the same concept arriving at problems that no one seems to have learned from. It's really quite astounding. But every company thinks they're going to be the one to do it because they're the special little snowflake and our company's so awesome and great, you know.
Yep.
But yeah, to quickly move along and I think, do a little bit of self-elating. I think we deserve it. You fuckers thought the Jag Type Zero was bad. Yeah? you all thought that was so bad. You thought, oh, this Jag looks terrible. And we were in there. We were in there at the start saying, no, this looks quite good, actually. And this is the reward you reap. All right.
Who's laughing now? Yeah. You've got your horrible, nasty fucking Mercedes.
I feel so vindicated. Oh, it looks bad because it's square, it's boxy. Oh, well, this is what happens when everything's fucking curves. You get the Luce and the AMG thing.
And
it looks good.
Oh, look, would you look at this? This is like the disguised road-going prototype they have of the Jag. And would you look? Oh, would you see that? It's a wing mirror. It's a wing mirror like we said it would have.
Yes.
And
it's almost as if concepts / prototypes don't necessarily have to reflect the production vehicle 100%.
And here's a crazy thing. It still looks good. It still actually looks quite good.
And it does look similar to the prototype, unlike the Mercedes.
Oh my god! And it
time will tell. I don't want to overcommit to this, and then Jaguar unveiled the actual production car, and it looks like
again,
shit.
There's a lot of disguising going on here. We don't know exactly how it's going to look.
However, I maintain hope, and I've liked this concept. Right from the start, right from when I originally saw it in the Jaguar Design Studio all those years ago, unfortunately, the bar is low. I think even in a timeline where the bar was higher, this would be a good-looking thing.
Yeah.
But we live in a timeline where the bar is incredibly low, and so I think it's going to... I think it's...
Yeah?
It'll be a slam dunk. Surely it's going to be a slam dunk.
It's being revealed in New York in October. We will see at that point how much they decide to deviate from the concept, if at all. And obviously there's still a lot that's hiding under the camouflage going on here. But, you know, we can see that the silhouette is pretty much the same. They've tried to disguise it as a four-door quite badly when you see, like, where they've tried to place the front... door handle relative to the wing mirror, but yes, I think I'm with you guys that it's I'm quietly hopeful. I'm not putting any money on it, but
yeah,
I have hope yet. It could still be quite good.
Yeah, I look forward to seeing them, and I don't look forward to seeing the other two, which I would say says enough.
Indeed. We are the best to ever do it, is basically what we're trying to say. Moving on.
Truth Nuke.
No car podcast does it like us.
Indeed. And by that we mean infrequently. But moving on to the Audi Nuvolari, which was also revealed fairly recently. This is sort of going to be the replacement for the R8, it would seem.
Well, they're only making 500 units, aren't they? It's kind of a special thing.
Yeah. But it's spiritual successor, I suppose. You could tag that vague, meaningless nonsense onto it.
I'd love to know both your thoughts on this, because I don't know how well I align with the kind of zeitgeist feeling on this. I'm not very tapped in.
Yeah.
You go first.
Okay, sure. My feeling on it is I don't hate it. I don't hate it at all. There is a lot in it, though, that does make me think they found a warehouse full of Murcielagos that they somehow hadn't sold.
Yeah.
the whole intake into the engine thing back there, very Murcielago. The picture from the back showing, like, where the exhaust is, very Murcielago. Even the front, like, if you sort of... Where the cheek intakes are, in a weird way, reminds me of a Murcielago. It's... I don't know how to feel about that, specifically.
Yeah.
To be fair, on the Audi website where they're showing this off, they show some of the design sketches they had, sort of, you know, back when they were in the design phase. And at that point, it looks a bit too much like a Bugatti. So, you know, I appreciate the shift in direction, at the very least, towards Lamborghini. But, yeah, I don't hate it, as I say. I just think it looks... It's lifting a lot from Lamborghini design language and trying to hide it with the sort of vertical Audi grille.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where if I look at it and squint, I'd quite like it. But the more I look at it, the... weirder, and the front grille being so narrow, no, and the like the side grills being so tall and reaching to those tiny headlights. No, the windscreen is very Lamborghini. I don't have anything against, but I just think it's a lot of it. I like the kind of general design language, and it does make me think if, you know, a more toned down version goes into production, like we, you know, like we used to see with the, you know, with the R8 and stuff, then, you know, maybe it would look nicer. But as it stands, the concept itself, I'm not huge on. I guess it's not a concept, but it's, you know, a limited production thing, isn't it? I don't know. It's
the Lambo stuff is unsurprising because it is based on the R8 Huracan platform. I'm relatively sure. I'm glad I asked you to go first because I get to contrast it now. Really like it. I think it's really good because I don't remember the last time I saw a supercar that went into production, albeit in this case limited, taking so many design risks. Because frankly, it is. There's a number of ways in which what this car is wrong. Right, I mean the thin the verticality of it in terms of that front end design in particular, that all the grills being taller than they are wide is a truly bizarre design decision that I really like. If it was the norm, I would not like it so much. But the fact that it's so unusual, the fact that it stands out. And I do think that this kind of really utilitarian color scheme that they're going with, this kind of grays on grays, this kind of gunmetal look, really suits it very well. It does look like a piece of industrial equipment. And I think every supercar currently on the market is trying to look cool or trying to look sleek. And this is trying to look like, how do you even describe it? It is just like, it's industrial in its look. And I don't remember, I can't think of another supercar that's gone into production, at least, that is unapologetically industrial in its appearance. And I can definitely personally give it that. Really like that. I think it's an interesting take. I think it does something that other cars don't do, despite being based on a relatively, widely sold platform for a supercar. I like it. I like it a lot.
Also, I will throw in, it's actually based on the Temerario rather than the Huracan and R8. But I would agree that I do like that it's taking risks, that it's not following the trend of a lot of the current supercar design languages. And also, it's bizarre, this car, in that this front three-quarter or front quarter angle is not its most flattering angle at all. Usually that's an angle you want to look quite good in a lot of cars, because where else you're gonna, very rarely you're gonna see a car dead on other angles. Dead on from the front is where I think this car looks best. Which I don't know if there's another car that does that off the top of my head.
It's got a real, you know how some cars, you look at them in pictures and it's fine, and then you see one in person and it's got presence.
Yes.
This thing has presence in pictures.
I cannot argue with that. It definitely has presence.
I actually really like it.
I certainly wouldn't say that I dislike it.
Me neither.
I'm not sure it works enough for me to think it looks really good, but I certainly don't think it's bad. And I like the direction that it seems to suggest that Audi may be going in for the future.
The rear is just a Murcielago, unfortunately. Like the rear is pure Murcielago through and through, I can't ignore that.
I'm not sure it's Murcielago. It's definitely Lamborghini.
Yeah, It's the sort of
Murcielago was a bit too long ago. It's kind of
the way it sits.
It's Reventon.
Reventon as well.
It is quite Reventon. Yeah.
I mean, the Reventon was based on the Murcielago, so maybe that's what my brain's thinking. But yeah, I think dead on from the front is this car's best angle, and it does look very imposing from the angle. And imposing is a bold choice to go for a supercar. So in that way, I'm glad it's here. You know, I'm glad it's here. If only just to shake things up a little bit, you know?
Yeah, I like it a great deal. In fact, I'm quite sad that it isn't an R8 replacement. I feel that this could have been the R8, like this could have been the R8 to the Temeraria, right? In the same way that the Audi R8 was the R8 to the Huracan and the Gallardo for all of those years. It's a shame that the R8 is gone. I think the concept of taking a Lamborghini base and going, okay, what can we do with the same basic architecture that's like the opposite is a really fucking cool idea. That's what this is to me, and I like it a lot.
Mm. Yeah, no, I can't disagree with a lot of that, and as I say, yeah, I'm glad it's here. And, I mean, these kinds of things, when they do a limited production run like this, firstly, it's to make shitloads of money, because they're always expensive, but also, it's to gauge interest in what they can achieve design-wise in production. So, obviously, car manufacturers always use concept cars to try and gauge interest, but this is a sort of test run of, like, we can produce these to a certain degree. Let's try something, like, cost it so that we can make a profit by not selling many of them. And even if it's, like, a disaster and everyone hates it, we'll, like, we won't be in the red too much.
Yeah.
It's a way for them to test what they can achieve design-wise in production and see how much people like it. And, you know, we might see some fruit from that in future Audi designs. And if it means Andy, yeah, I'll make Andy. if it means Audi buck the BMW and Mercedes trend, please God.
And so, can I just say as well, less expensive than a Luce.
It is less expensive than a Luce.
Yeah, that all that does is highlight how ridiculous the Luce pricing is.
Yes. Moving on, this is the Vision BMW Alpina, is what they're calling it. This is the first Alpina thing that has been unveiled post-BMW purchase of Alpina. And I'm trying to recall what I said last episode. I'm pretty sure I said that BMW were going to try and move Alpina into their Maybach equivalent, was what they were going to try and turn it into, where you'd have a bit more customization on offer and that sort of thing going on. So that's just another angle of attack for BMW to have on the super expensive luxury stuff. And with the unveiling of this, it's not the exact direction I thought they were going to go in with it, but it's still quite similar to what I thought they were going to do. This shows that I think they're going to try and make Alpina a lot more custom, almost like a coach-built version of a very luxurious BMW to fit whatever gap exists between BMW and Rolls-Royce.
I'm not sure it's quite. It's very much still more the BMW end of that.
Oh, absolutely, spectrum. But I think and these won't be nearly as expensive as a Rolls Royce either. But I imagine they're aiming for the kind of person who wants something very unique, who wants something that no one else on the road will have, who want to spend shitloads of money on something, but want to be seen as sort of being sporty rather than old money Rolls-Royce.
Mm-hmm.
I'd really be fascinated to know where this fits price-wise. Do we have any information on that?
Because there's not even really confirmation that what we're looking at is going to be a production car. So
sure, because to me this is like, I'm trying to think of analogs for it, and I keep arriving back at the Lexus LC.
Yeah,
as like a point
obviously
of
this fits. Obviously, this would fit above it price wise, but yes. How far above it could it actually land without seeming silly? I don't know. And BMW's base prices on cars like this are already in that territory.
Because we have to envision that this is going to be more expensive than an M8. This will be more expensive than an M8. And you can already make an M8 into, like, what, £180,000,
£190,000? Fucking hell, really? Yeah. I knew you could push them into... I kind of assumed that they were topping out about... 130, 140. You can make an M8 at nearly 200 grand car.
I'm going to double check that while we're talking, but I'm fairly confident in that.
I'm not a BMW hater. I don't kind of subscribe to the really kind of European car makes, and their fans can get incredibly tribalistic.
Oh, yeah.
If you're spending 200 grand on an M8, you need a fucking head scan.
Yeah.
But I mean, I just look at this. I'm just going to chuck my pin. I think it looks really fucking good.
I think it looks great. I think it looks fantastic.
I'm a big, big fan. I mean, it's quite. I'm a little undecided on the kind of the shock nose, but then I think back to, you know, the old 6 Series, and yeah, I forgive it. I think it looks good, and I'm, you know, if this goes into production, I certainly think it's the kind of thing you'd see on, you know, drive past and give it a double take. It's just whether, you know, if they do put it into production, or if this is the kind of direction that that BMW are taking Alpina, whether it's going to be something that people are interested in, whether, you know, depending on how expensive it is, whether they're actually going to get bought, or, you know, I guess, you know, an Alpina was always a rare beast, but if they're spending a lot of money making an Alpina, you know, a completely different body shell, then you would expect they probably want to sell a lot more or make a hell of a lot more profit.
That's the thing, right? Is this car at 125 is a huge winner.
Yeah.
This car at 325, tough.
Yeah. Also, I will not be able to verify to you how much you can make an M8 cost, because they've taken it off the UK configurator.
Which I think is the only way of being able to determine how much things cost.
Yes, of course. But what that means is, and I've just double checked, I don't know whether it's already happened or if they're going to do it this year, but the 8 Series is being discontinued this year.
Which is
very interesting then that they've announced this at around the same time. Again, like, I think that it definitely has a look to it. I like this a lot more than anything else BMW has put out recently.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, BMW's been having an absolute howler when it comes to design. And this, it just is good. This is a good-looking car.
Yeah. Whether it actually makes it to production, we will have to wait and see. Quickly moving on, this is something we could have talked about last time, but I think we kind of glossed over. This is, well, the family, the Bofensiepen family, it's like monstrously German name, are the sort of family who have owned and run Alpina since its inception, as I understand it. Evidently, BMW gave them an offer for a lot of money for Alpina. They decided, oh, thank you very much, we'll accept that. Turned around and immediately just launched their own company again and kept doing Alpina stuff, which...
not only launched their own, but launched a car that actually looks even fucking better.
Yeah, it is gorgeous.
I mean,
it's so 850 CSI, I think.
The front is still a bit too high for that for me, but I see what you're getting at.
I mean, those two... you know, it's very much a, do I want the really juicy steak or the really buttery lobster? Uh-huh. But either way, uh-huh. I'm happy that, you know, if this is the competition we're getting, who can make the prettier car? I welcome this for the rest of eternity. I mean, I love the idea that, you know, isn't that kind of... I'm fairly sure that's the kind of dream of every, you know, everyone who does, you know, does something well, is that you get paid a huge amount of money to sell it, and then you have a huge amount of money to go do it, but better.
Even better. I mean, this yeah. is
great.
This is how German, this is how the German automotive industry survives. Like, this is the only path forward that they have, because they can't compete with the Chinese makes on price. It's going to become increasingly difficult to compete on materials quality and build quality. And so you've got to find what your USP is. And BMW have made ugly cars for years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know,
yeah.
if they can... And unfortunately, even now they've acquired Alpina. The prettiest BMW is still being made by a company that isn't owned by them.
Yes. Well, technically, yeah. technically what Zagato, because this is the Bofen Siepen Zagato. She Bofen on my Siepen till I Zagato.
But they are also making a variant of the like a 5 Series model.
Yeah.
I think it's based only on the estate, which is even cooler. And you know, it's kind of got the same kind of gist that Alpina had, where it's, you know, a 5 Series, but with a bit more, bit, you know, higher end touches, a bit sportier, but still being comfortable. Fair play to them. I hope they do brilliantly with these.
Kind of find slightly confusing about this whole thing, right, is BMW's, I don't actually know how much they spent on Alpina. Is that,
they're a publicly traded public knowledge.
Company. We probably will know. There'll be a filing somewhere.
I'm not sure if Alpina was ever publicly traded.
No, but BMW is. And right, so okay, the amount of money that they spent to get it will
they
be
spend,
known
yeah,
somewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. I actually do kind of see why they bought Alpina, right? But when a car like this Bofen Siepen Zagato thing arrives, how is BMW not paying, like, the, you know, this kind of gold rush to get the best developers to work at AI companies, and they're just paying like insane salaries. How is BMW not going, we need to pay whatever it takes to get the fucking designer of that car on our team?
Yeah,
I don't get it.
Yeah, it's a tough thing. Unfortunately, I have just learned something that's made me quite sad. So they're only making 99 Bofen Siepen Zagatos. And, do you want to know how much they're going to cost?
Oh, God.
How much?
£321,000.
That's less bad than I was anticipating for a run of 99.
But as a kind of coach-built vehicle and as a kind of design showcase for the new company, I really don't think that's bad. I mean,
yeah, it's not,
it's a lot of money, but
it's a lot of money for, and it does look good, don't get me wrong. The problem is I can still see a lot of the underlying BMW in it.
It does still look, but that's what gave rise to the thought of why don't BMW hire these people, because it's like, it's really not what a BMW, a modern BMW BMW looks like. Modern BMW BMWs look awful. But this is, it still carries enough of that kind of slightly intangible BMW DNA in its design that it could be a BMW. It could be a really good looking BMW. It is a really good looking BMW. Why can't BMW make cars that look like this and sell them for a third of that price and sell actually like tens, if not hundreds of thousands of them?
God only knows.
We'd have to consult the goblin that sits at the top of the car industry and make sure all new cars look bad.
I guess this would be a good time to engage with the audience. Do you all agree that this is a good looking car? Do you all agree that this is better looking than what BMW currently make? Like, are we in some kind of strange like bubble whereby do normal people think that BMWs are good looking cars out the box?
I mean, help. Enough must, but I don't know. I think they've definitely, to sound like my age as a Zoomer, they fell off quite heavily, and it's been disappointing to see. But I mean, I've just been looking at this thing more because I'm absolutely in love with it. And I mean, look at this rear three quarters. I would, 300 grand, if I had it in my bank account, sure. If that's what it costs, I'd take it.
That is a fantastic piece of design. Oh, I love the kind of
the bubble, the curvy, the bubble,
yeah,
canopy. Well. Yeah,
it's so such as good.
It's such a Zagato mainstay, and it looks so good. It looks so good.
Oh, I'm going to get distracted after this because I've just found they have a configurator.
Oh,
I
yeah,
that's
the,
a very
although,
good
actually.
Car.
This is weird. I've noticed the Bofen Siepen configurator, because I had a quick look at it, is in its UI identical to the old Alpina configurator.
I guess they must have
well,
been able to keep
stuff.
Because
it was built by the same person.
Built by the same person, yeah. But like even the Alpina one, when I was messing around on it a few years ago, looked outdated. It looks dated now when they rebuilt it for Bofen Siepen. So I don't know, maybe their clientele is like a sort of weird, like Bristol kind of clientele, where all the people buying it are in their 70s and don't know how to use the internet unless it looks like Web 1.0.
It's also, I think, it's a bit of a status thing to like not need a slick website.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, no, that's yeah. Absolutely a thing. Yeah,
your product is what people are there for. You know, if people are put off by the website, they weren't really there for you anyway.
Yeah, that's yeah. This thing looks good, I think, is the long and short of it. The Alpina, Vision Alpina thing looks good as well. Maybe BMW are learning how to design a car, and if not, they can hopefully learn it from Zagato.
Yeah,
they just need to they just need to acquire Bofen Siepen and Zagato.
Yes.
And then they'll be fine.
The Bofen Siepen family just turn their business model into founding new companies that become too good for BMW to not buy.
I'm aware of a scenario like that playing out in automotive Britain. I can't really say that much more.
interesting. Moving on to something finally that is not an actual car. We're talking boring business things. Business boring.
Woke.
Boo. Business.
But yes, so this was something I didn't see a whole lot of buzz around, but I thought it was pertinent to point out nonetheless. There was a leaked survey of Volkswagen's board members, of their 9 board members. This survey showed that 6 of them believed the company was existentially threatened. And that all 9 of them backed a radical strategy change and criticized VW's approach in China and North America.
It sounds doom and gloom, right? Because it is. I'd love to know what's going on in the heads of the 3 who don't think that VW's existentially threatened. I'd love to live in their world. Whatever it is they get up and take in the morning, I want some.
Yes. So
pure
what's happened here is Q1 BMW, fuck, Jesus. Q1 VW had a pretty sharp fall off in profits. A lot of this can be placed at the foot of VW's China strategy, which basically for a number of years, to be fair, has worked for them. But that strategy has been do nothing.
Yeah.
They set up some, you know, VW got in China very early. They got in way before basically anyone else had. And that gave them an inroad that they profited off of very well for a number of years. VW has experienced a lot, and the VW group in general has experienced a lot of success in the Chinese market through the 2000s, through the 2010s, and basically up until now. The problem is that they pretty much just sat on their laurels while China developed a local car industry that completely and very rapidly began outperforming them on price, on performance, and on sort of national pride of, you know, it's become quite important to a lot of young Chinese car buyers that they buy a car that is a Chinese company. That's become quite important to them.
Yeah, and I think the issue is that I guess they just believed that the infinite money printer would never run out while they, you know, were still, you know, obviously they made a name for themselves in China, but that doesn't last forever, you guys. And I guess I would say somebody should have seen this coming, but...
Yeah, and...
Well, I think, you know, you say that they were sat on their laurels. I think that was the right call, because I honestly, I think every penny that they invested to try and hold China would have been they would have had a return of absolutely zero. I think there is absolutely no scenario in which VW were ever going to be able to compete with the Chinese domestic manufacturers.
No.
And I think it will be a miracle if they're able to compete outside of China. But, you know, to think it was ever possible that they were going to be able to compete domestically is a pipe dream. So it's good, actually, that they didn't throw countless billions at trying to hold onto a market they were guaranteed to lose.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that that's what they should have done. But basically what I'm trying to say with that is they sat on their laurels and didn't do anything regarding their Chinese strategy, and they have not reinvested that into developing a business model post the rise of Chinese domestic manufacturers. They just thought like the current state of affairs would continue forever. And also, like, because also bringing into it, their North American strategy has been criticized by the company's board members. It's like, come on, guys, aren't you responsible for this? Because basically what VW Group's business model has been for a very long time is develop the cars in Germany, build them in Europe, and then export them across the world. So, of course, across Europe, you know, so obviously you have Skoda and Seat, you know, sort of outside of Germany. But because I was surprised, actually, like VW Group have like what, two factories in America, something like that. Maybe not even that.
Yeah,
it's, and they were both built surprisingly late. You know, it wasn't like the Japanese manufacturers who got in there very, very early, some cases in like the 80s and 90s, and now have multiple factories and much bigger ones. Good God, like, you know, the size of the Toyota factory in Texas pumping out Tundras is enormous. Yeah. VW haven't really specialized in having a proper US market offering in the same way even like BMW did. Because I mean, like, you can get a BMW X7 in Europe, but the X7 is really designed for America, really. I'm pretty sure it's made in America, even. I'm going to quickly double check.
Would not be surprised.
I'm cooking up a thought. And it's quite an extreme thought.
I'm scared, but continue.
So, there's a handful of car companies at the moment that are doing all right.
I just want to quickly interject. Sorry, just say I'm right. I'm correct. The X7 is built in South Carolina. Sorry, continue.
Good stuff. Great accent, by the way. I'm sure we're going to get lots of comments from American viewers saying how accurate that was.
Yes.
Yeah. There's not a lot of car companies, rather, at the moment that are doing well, and one of them that is doing well, weirdly, despite all of our bashing over the time that we've done this podcast, is Ford. Ford is currently doing okay. Now, one of the reasons that Ford is currently doing okay is that...
By skimping out on every single component that they make in everything.
Well, that, but refocusing on their primary market. They cut off the gangrenous leg that was Europe and refocused almost entirely on North America. And so it would be extreme. It would require an enormous reassessment of their business. But I think if VW is likely to have a chance at being anything close to a major automotive manufacturer for the next several decades, it needs to exit China, it needs to exit North America, and it needs to refocus heavily on Europe and potentially Africa, and then maybe they'll survive.
Yeah, I think, well, at the very least, exit China and America in mass market segments. I think their, you know, luxury offerings are always going to sell everywhere, but you can't, as you've pointed out, you can't compete with the growth of Chinese makers, especially within China, on price. You can't compete with them on tech, because in a lot of ways, in terms of battery and electric car tech, Chinese companies are a lot of the ones leading the way. So
yeah, they are. And the only way that VW is going to survive in Europe is with favorable trade policy and an aggressive tariff regime by the EU, right? But even if they get the regulatory environment that is going to favor them as much as possible, that only protects them in Europe. They were always going to be they were always going to be competing on pure merit, maybe even at a disadvantage in China.
Yeah.
And to an extent, North America as well. And you know, we simply live in a world now where VW can't win a fair fight, and they certainly can't win one stacked against them.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, certainly. I mean, it's. I feel like this is kind of, to me, it seems like the classic case of getting a little too comfortable, and especially I think in China, but I think in America, it's, for me, it seems like more of a case of not necessarily adapting to the market, really. I mean, you know, they try to adapt to the market, but the products aren't good enough, really. I mean, they've got, you know, a selection of, you know, mid-sized to large SUVs, all of which are absolutely nothing to write home about.
Dizzying array of them,
yeah,
frankly.
Yeah, and what else? If I'm talking about America specifically, the Golf and the Jetta, and I think that's about it at this point. I mean, yeah, well, I mean, the, you know, obviously people want a Golf GTI, they're going to buy a Golf GTI, but apart from that, what would lead you to any of these vehicles over anything else, really? Because they don't have the, you know, they're priced higher than, you know, when it comes to Korean or Japanese manufacturers, but I don't think they have the quality to back that up. You know, I think in Europe, I think we kind of seem to accept a lot more. I mean, you can get like an Audi A1 that's got absolutely nothing added to it and people will buy them. But I think in the US, it's kind of a lot more important, you know, to have, I guess, the proof that the money you've spent is worth it. And, you know, I don't think VWs really give that these days.
I think their luxury sub-brands can survive.
Yeah, that's sort of what I was thinking about, yeah. You know,
yeah, exactly. I mean, the kind of the big long wheelbase Audis, they'll still sell in China. Your Lamborghinis, you know, they're not going to stop selling Lamborghini in North America. That would be insane. But as you say, the kind of more mass market cars, like, is it worth VW trying to? I guess they're trying some interesting things. They're doing the Scout thing. It's going to be interesting to see how Scout does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, maybe North America's a slightly more complicated one, but the chances of VW being able to hold on to anything in China is zero. It's already gone.
Yeah.
They need to, and they are exiting China. I think it's happening slowly. They've not done a full we're no longer selling cars in China type thing. But we spoke months ago about the fact that they were selling Chinese factories. It's, you know, they had it good for a little while the you know, the Chinese domestic auto industry was not really there properly yet. And now it is, and they can't beat them, so it's time to go. The regulatory regime in America is making things incredibly difficult. It remains to be seen how long that's going to go on for in the future, but it would take America being incredibly kind to European companies and effectively hurting American consumers for the sake of European companies, which, to be honest, I can't really see even a left-wing government being particularly interested in doing, because it's just like, why? What benefit is it to Americans to keep VW afloat? They don't give a fuck.
No, absolutely. Given current American governance, I can't see them being particularly interested in that prospect at all.
No, but I don't know. It's unfortunate, but I'm not particularly surprised. I mean, have you sat in a VW recently? The quality control is not, well, I guess just the quality of the materials really is not really there. And I think they kind of cannibalize a lot of their own sales in Europe by going for, you know, making a brand for every single, you know, possible price point. You know, you get Skoda that's below, but, you know, they also have hot Skodas that people seem to like almost as much, if not more, as hot VWs these days. You've got, obviously, Audis and...
Cooper exists somewhere in there. What's the difference between a hot Skoda and a Cupra?
No idea, you know, they're just cannibalizing their own sales, it seems to me. I mean, obviously, you know, any money is good money, but for Volkswagen itself as a brand, I don't think... I think they're shooting themselves in the foot by making, you know, trying to make every brand cool and, you know, sell as many as possible, but then not doing enough to make VW, you know, and as a
it doesn't
as an
seem well
mark.
Coordinated.
No, and you know, I mean, if it were up to me, I would have a few suggestions. I for one, you know, the new ID Polo that's coming out. I quite like that thing. You know what I think they should do? I think they should bring back the Harlequin. But that would be. Can you imagine? I think personally, there are a lot of people, you know, by the sales of the Renault 5 seems to suggest to me that people, when they're looking for...
They like funky,
you know,
little things.
They like funky electric, you know, if they're going for an electric city car, they like stuff that's funky. You know, you get the Abarth electric ones. When I occasionally see one of those, it's always in that neon green.
There's an Aura Cat that's appeared in my area. Although I have to say, the Aura Cat is... huge.
It's a big car.
Sorry,
it's like the size of an Ioniq 5.
But yeah, I think they should, you know, try and make, and you know, VW, when I think of VW, I always think of like VW of the 90s, when, you know, the Mark 3 Golf and had all its ridiculous tie-ins, you know, the Plink Floyd edition and the, you know, I swear there was like a Bon Jovi one or something, you know, and now VW are just grayscale cars and have nothing that appeals about them versus other brands and even other VW group brands. I don't understand what their end goal is.
Yeah, it's doesn't make a whole lot of sense, frankly.
No, but what do I know?
Yeah, I think VW are in for, and you know, it's why the, you know, that poll of VW board members, it's not surprising. And it's, if anything, it should be reassuring to people who work in and around the company that leadership can see it.
Yes.
I think it would be a lot scarier, frankly, if it was the opinion of VW leadership that there was not an existential threat to the business. Because clearly, if they want the company to survive, it's going to need to change.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's sad. I do find it a bit sad. As somebody, I'm not a massive VW person, but I could certainly name you a dozen VWs that I like and that I'd like to own. And I don't know. It's just a shame, you know. I guess sentimentality doesn't really hold much in terms of making companies money, but I certainly think they should have seen this China thing coming a while ago. And, you know, whether, as Fred's saying, they should have just pulled out completely or whether they should have tried to adapt more, either way, they put too many eggs in that basket, and it's now biting them, especially with America also and Europe not being, you know, they're competing with themselves. I think they've screwed themselves in so many ways.
Yeah, it's funny because
I'm
of all
not
the companies,
sure what they should have done.
Of all the companies doing quite well in Europe right now, some of the Stellantis brands are doing really well in Europe. You know, if we're sort of thinking about ways in which doubling down on Europe can be quite good, or a way for the VW group to survive, like the 208 overtook the Golf as the best-selling car in Europe like a few years ago.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, I'm not too surprised really, because the, you know, Stellantis stuff, you know, is cheap. You know, feels cheap, but is cheap. I think VWs feel cheap, but they're not as cheap as other cars that feel about the same.
You can spend a lot of money on a Golf.
Yeah.
On a Golf. Like, you can spend serious, serious money on a Golf. Like, that's surely not sustainable.
You know, when you're being outflanked by Stellantis, something has gone really fucking badly wrong.
Yes.
Yeah, I think I would kind of quit at that point personally, but what do I know?
But quickly moving on, Ford was briefly mentioned, and I added this as the podcast was ongoing because I remembered it and thought it would be funny to talk about.
What is this?
So
I'm not aware of this.
I mean, so firstly,
is this a rebodied Renault 5?
This is an Auto Express render, so don't, you know, take it with a pinch of salt. But Ford have announced.
I've missed our Auto Express renders.
Yes, yeah, so your auto car renders.
Renders. It's been way too long. It has.
It's been nice to see a returning friend. Yeah. But Ford has not completely abandoned Europe insofar as they're just getting other companies to do it for them. So a lot of like the upcoming electric cars from Ford in Europe are based on VW platforms, and they have announced that the Fiesta will return, and it will be based...
They're not calling a rebodied R5 a Fiesta, are they?
And they're basing it on the Renault 5.
Great.
The Renault 5 did really well, and every manufacturer went, what could we do that's similar?
Let's just do it.
And I like the fact that Renault seems to be approached by anyone who's like, hey, can we rebody your car?
Yeah.
And they're like, yeah, sure, money for us.
Renault must just be like behind the scenes doing like the perfect golden ratio spread of money up their arm. Like, my God, like Nissan are paying them for the 5, Ford are paying them for the 5. Like, pretty soon, all cars are going to be based on the Renault 5, which, of course, underneath we know is itself a Renault 12.
Well, of course.
Wow, this is incredible. Renault world domination is coming back.
This is what I mean with what I was talking about with VW, right? Is Renault have... They really focused in on what they can do and what they know and where they can win, right? Mm-hmm. Renault is proof that you can outcompete Chinese cars if you just do what you do best really well.
Yeah. So, you know, because... I haven't really seen anyone who's had a particularly bad word to say about the 5.
No, me neither.
The interior looks nice and apparently feels quite nice.
Yeah, I've sat in one. It was perfectly pleasant to be in.
Yeah. It's an electric car, so it's got a decent turn of speed out the gate, almost by default, which would make it a fun thing to drive around the city. And it looks funky. Yeah. Like... Yeah, what more could you possibly really want?
I mean, I've probably seen hundreds at this point, honestly. There seems to be quite a lot where I live. And it's quite a testament to the design that I still look at them. I mean, yes, it's probably because they're all yellow, but that's part of it. A car in a colour is worth looking at. But even when they're not, I think yeah, I'm happy that my eyes have rested upon this Renault 5 because it looks nice.
Yeah, and an entry level price, granted, you know, you don't get a lot, you don't get like extended range and like all manner of luxury stuff, but an entry level price of £25,000 roughly, I'm pretty sure that's what it is, mm-hmm. for an electric car in 2026 is a pretty good deal. And that's not even to mention like the Dacia Spring and all of the Dacia stuff that undercuts it even more. And the upcoming Twingo, which is going to be quite cheap as well.
Mm-hmm. Starts from 22, the R5.
22 even, there you go. And wow. the Twingo is supposed to be under 20 when it launches.
Renault are killing it, I'd say. And I mean,
which again, is quite nice. Quite nice for us to be able to say, because that's something we've been saying for a while.
Yeah, and I guess if Ford... But I don't understand this, really, because I just... You know, I mean, I guess I can understand it from a financial perspective, but Jesus, Ford. I mean, seriously, you know, for all the decades of making what could probably be called the quintessential British family car, from the Escort, you know, the Fiesta or the Focus, and then the it's just all of that to what, a rebadged Renault
that I don't entirely get it, to be honest, because I'm trying to work out, like,
because
presumably this is going to be more expensive than the Renault badged one because two companies have to make a profit on it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So
surely,
but like, who values Ford more highly than Renault in their mind when it comes to an electric five-door hatchback?
I mean, when presented with the option of the 5, the fucking, the Micra, and a potential Fiesta, who's going for anything other than the 5? I can envision a world, like, if you're a dumb person who doesn't think about anything else, and you look at the Micra and you think, oh, it's got cute eyes, that's the only thing I can think, you know?
Yeah. Maybe because the Fiesta's got a lot, it's got... I guess Fiesta's got cachet in the UK.
Yeah.
Again, like, but how...
Are you burning that cachet by just making it another car?
Yes, is the answer to that. Yeah. But will it sell a few units? Probably. Maybe it will. Is it going to... I mean, yeah, I don't know. It doesn't really matter if they don't sell that many of them because it's not a new car. It's cars that they'll just be badging them.
Yeah.
And replacing the bumpers based on apparent demand.
Yeah. I don't massively understand Ford's Europe strategy because at the moment all its electric stuff...
I think Ford's Europe strategy is fuck Europe.
Yeah. okay, we'll take the fucking VW ID4, give it a different body and call it a Capri. Fuck it, why not? Make a Ford Explorer boxy version of it while you're at it as well. They've given up any hope of sort of actively growing Ford Europe and are just coasting on and making whatever little trickle of money of it they can while they're still there.
Yeah, I mean, they've doubled down on North America. They've basically said as much. Yeah. And that is, I think, probably... I wouldn't say it's the better business decision. I think there is a reality in which they were able to continue being successful in Europe, but it started to falter and they went, is it going to be worth the billions that it's going to take to get this back up to where it needs to be? No, actually. So let's fuck it off.
Yeah.
And I think some of the European manufacturers could maybe learn a thing or two from that. Focus on what you're good at. And what Ford's good at is selling trucks in America.
Yeah.
What Renault's good at is selling hatchbacks in Europe.
But I thought Ford were really, really good at selling hatchbacks in Europe as well. I mean,
They were, but they haven't been for a while.
Also, I will have to correct you. Ford is best at recalling trucks in America.
Oh,
that's true. Yes.
True.
My bad.
Well,
that's a podcast, actually, right there. And
what's the
summary? We came in maybe about 10, 15 minutes shorter than the previous episode, so I didn't lie at the beginning.
Okay. I rescind my fuck you or whatever I said.
see us and say hi at Festival of the Unexceptional if you happen to bump into us. Yeah. Yeah.
And if you see us along the A1M, please pick us up.
Yes.
Yeah, just, yeah, if you see me by the A1M, and I do still have a pulse.
Run you over?
5W30, I'll need.
Oh, that's what it takes, 5W30, Dan. Well, anyway. Thank you. And, I look forward to being proven completely wrong about every opinion I've had very soon, especially by Indeed. The comments.
Indeed. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye.